Well, we want to just give Dr. Sam Chand a chance to come and just share with us. And I appreciate him so much. One of the things I do is, as I travel, I love the relationships that God gives me. And I love being able to bring some of them back here and just have them exposed to you guys and get a chance to hear them. One of the things that always stands out to me when I talk with Sam Chand or hear him is the world has this ability to make what they do sound complex and important. So if you ever talk with somebody who's trying to make themselves sound smart, brilliant, they'll convolute their system of work and what they do, and you find out later that, you know, he collects garbage, but the way it was all described, it's deep, it's hard. And people can do that, both with the Word of God. If you hear a person preach, you kind of go, that was awesome. What do you say? I don't know, but that was awesome. That's not awesome, okay? So one guy was talking to me one time. He said, you're pretty simple. I said, I'm in good company. Jesus talked about goats, sheep, pearls, and his stories are around the world. Doesn't matter what religion, people will know about the parable of the prodigal son. They'll know the parable. So the true brilliance to me, I'm never impressed by gobbledygook. What I'm impressed by is a man that can take brilliant things and make them simple. And just, you can do what I do. I think those are the most valuable people on the planet. And this man absolutely does that. So give him a hand as Dr. Sam Chan comes and
I'm fully aware they're the only thing standing between dessert and you. So I'm not feeling any pressure at all. It's great to be at Springs, and as I said this morning in the church, there are not many churches that have, let alone a global vision, a global impact, and you definitely do that. So just want, on behalf of the people you'll meet in heaven because of your presence in this room, yeah, I want to say thank you to you in advance. There will be people who walk up to you and say thank you. And you'll say, and who are you? And they will say, it's because of you that I'm here. And that's going to be amazing, isn't it? Yeah. How God will connect the dots for us. Now, I know you're kingdom builders, and I know that you give, and I know that you bought your ticket, an expensive ticket, to be in this room. But that's not why you are here. You're not here because you give. You're here because you have a gift, and that's the gift of generosity. Yeah. There's some people who give but don't have a gift of generosity. They give for different reasons. There are all kinds of motivations to give. But the gift of generosity is manifested through giving. And so the churches have done well in get people who are good with people, they give them people responsibilities with children responsibility. You see, musical responsibilities. But I'm so glad that you're at a church that knows that generosity is a gift of the Spirit too. And that you have a pastor who sees that gift and is not trying to get more money, but is trying to make sure that your gift grows. It's really about generosity. It's not about giving. Giving is just a way of showing that. In my previous life, for 15 years, I was a university president in Atlanta from 1989 to 2003. I did not realize that when I went into that situation, what is really needed for a university president. Do you call them presidents here, vice chancellor? What do you call them? president, okay? You may know this or not, but 70% of what a university president does is raise money. Our job description is freshman, funds, facilities. So freshman is more students, funds is money, and facilities is just keep building to accommodate the growth, if there is growth. So I did not realize that I would have to learn the art of asking for money. I didn't have to actually do that before that. The first thing you find out about asking for money is to get to know people who have money. You know, you don't go fishing where there is no fish. So I started hanging around people who had money, because I had a budget to meet. Part of our budget was X amount is going to be donor dollars. So I had to raise, I averaged it out. I got to raise this much every week. So lots of breakfast, lots of lunches, lots of casting vision. And it's different for university, because at least at church, you get some services every week, twice a week. You have access to things going on. And as I was working with one of my friends, his name is Kevin Miller. Kevin Miller used to be a gazillionaire. And, he was way beyond net worth, I mean, all of that. So one day I am with him at lunch and, trying to shake some money out of him. I mean, after a while they see you coming, it's like, okay, I know what he wants. After the first 30 seconds of hi, hello, how's the family? Hey, listen, we need to talk. So that is what I did. I mean, if you looked at my calendar, if you looked at my daily calendar, there were at least three fundraising appointments on my calendar every day. Mm-hmm. It's called fundraising fatigue. That's why in America, the average tenure of a university president is 7 years. I was there for 15. I must have sinned a lot in my previous life, and so it's like, okay, you're going to do time. So I was doing hard labor. So I was meeting with Kevin Miller in a downtown restaurant in Atlanta, a Chinese restaurant. And I knew what he is worth, because he was a known quantity. And the way that our business, so I had a development department. I'm going somewhere with this. I had a development department in which I had a full-time staff, and they would do the background on everybody that I'd meet with. And they would tell me how much they're worth, if they give, if they don't give, who do they give it to, what amounts do they give to, what's their average size gift, what kinds of things they like to give to. So I might find out that he likes giving to libraries, and she likes giving scholarships, and he likes giving scholarships to Kenya, and so you find out all those things about them. Do you all have Chick-fil-A's over here? Not yet, okay, but some of you go to the States, you know what I'm talking about. So like Truett Cathy, he gave me an appointment. I'm going to get to Kevin Miller in just a moment. So Chick-fil-A has got its headquarters in Atlanta. Truett is a believer. So I had a 10-minute appointment with him. That's what they gave me. And so I found out very quickly in the first 5 minutes, there's no money here for me. So I just started getting up to leave. And I said, thank you so much for your time. And on the wall was a big picture with him and a bunch of young people. But my office had told me that he has 87 foster children, and he pays for all of their everything. So as I was leaving, I looked at the picture, said 10-minute appointment. I said, your children, huh? 3 hours later, I walked out with a check, and he told me about every one of them. So I'm here with Kevin Miller, in a Chinese restaurant, and I know what he does and what's he valued. Believer, loves Jesus. And I asked him a question. I said, Kevin, why are you still working? Because he's still working. Why are you still working? You could chill, relax. You got so much money, you can't spend it. I mean, there's just no way you can spend all your money. Your children can, but you can't. And he looked at me and said something that changed my life. Kevin Miller said to me, he said, Sam, the reason I'm working is because I still haven't reached my giving goals. Say what? I can help you get there. Obviously, it's a big number, and I'll come in under that number. I'll take half of whatever you're thinking. I have not reached my giving goals. This had to be somewhere in the early 90s. It just messed with my head. Because I've always been a giver. I was born and raised in a pastor's home, so whenever somebody would give us any money, my dad deducted the tithe before he gave us the rest. I mean, so I started off with early deductions, you know. And then after that, I remember the first argument Brenda and I had. We were married in 1979. First argument, Portland, Oregon. She had a job. I didn't have a job. So we're sitting Sunday morning, and she's writing out the tithe check. And I looked at the tithe check, and it was more than what I had calculated it to be. And I said to her, that's more than your tithe. And then we had a little calculation, and she said, oh, we figured out that she was tithing on her gross. And I was always tithed on my net, take home pay. And, you know, I said, yeah. So we're having this conversation, and she said to me, she said, Sam, it just depends on what you want the Lord to bless. Your net or your gross? She won that one. So it messed with my head. So I've always been a, you know, giver, and I thought I was generous. So I get in the car, and I call Brenda, and I say, hey, Brenda, what are we giving? So she said, we do this. I said, cool. So I said to her, over dinner tonight, can we just talk about our giving? So she says, yeah, let's do that. I said, can you get some numbers together? So she did. We're having dinner. And at that dinner, we made a family decision, her and I, that by the time I'm of a certain age, that we want to give away 90% and live off 10%. And we called it reverse tithing. So I didn't know how to figure it out. I did not know how to make that work. It was something that we felt we wanted to do in our family. We just didn't know how to get there. So I met with our financial team, our CPA, our financial planner, and so on and so forth. Met with them, made an appointment, and said to them, hey, listen, so we are sitting around the table in a nice conference room in their offices, and I said to them, hey, listen, Brenda and I, by this age, want to give away 90% and live off 10. After he picked himself off the floor, what? He said, now, why do you want to do that? So I explained to him why. He's a believer too, but just because a believer does not mean he's generous. That's why this room is not full. And so I explained everything to him, and started putting a plan on it. And I want you to know that just knowing how God blesses everything, just knowing how generosity works, not giving, how generosity works. Because generosity is just how you start living, how you start thinking. Remember the story in Mark chapter 12? In Mark chapter 12, there is Jesus is hanging around the offering place, and people are putting in their offering. That's interesting by itself. Jesus could have hung around any time, but no, he's going to hang around where people are giving. You know, it's like, okay, let me see what's in that envelope. And so the Bible tells us that a lot of rich people came, verses 40 and on, Mark chapter 12, and they start putting money in the, I guess it was an open basket of some nature. And there's this widow who came by and put in a couple pennies. The Bible says this, Jesus called his disciples, saying, hey, look, 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 look. This woman gave the most. You were kidding, Jesus. I know you're a carpenter and all that, but we can count money. We see all the checks. We see all the stocks that are being donated. We see all the cash that is there. Two pennies? Jesus, you feeling all right? And then Jesus explained how he keeps record. Because the rich folk, the Bible tells us, gave out of the abundance, and just another day, another dollar. But Jesus said the way he keeps tabs is that she gave everything. And the way Jesus counts generosity is not how much we give, but how much is left over for us. That's a really different way of thinking, but I guess that's a Jesus way of thinking. And that's what started messing with my head when Kevin Miller said to me, I have not reached my giving goals. So most of my life, in those days, at least till 2003, and even still since then, has been around people who are resourced, materially and financially. And I started looking at the lives of generous people like you in this room, and I learned a few things about generous people. And I want to give you about 27 of those. Just checking. Yeah, in case you're wondering, all of them are right here. It's my PowerPoints right over here, right here. Number one, it's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle. It's not compartmentalized. It's a lifestyle. You are not just generous at Springs. You're generous everywhere you go. When you go to a restaurant, you're generous with your server. When somebody approaches you with a need, you're generous with that. If you have employees, you're generous with them. If there's a need in your neighborhood, you're generous with that. If your friend has a need, it's a lifestyle. It's not something you do just at church. It's a lifestyle of generosity. The second thing is, and I think this is a really big one, you encourage others on their generosity journey to become more generous. There are some people who are at Springs who have your gift of generosity, but nobody's ever challenged them. It's one thing for, by the way, Pastor Leon said, here are my notes, can you get up there and read it? So everything I'm saying is because he told me to say. No, I'm just totally kidding about that. It is one thing for the pastor to encourage people on the generosity journey. That's what I call it, a generosity journey. I'm not there, you're not there. I don't think anybody's there on a generosity journey. It's one thing for him to do that. And I get that. That is his role, that is his calling. As a pastor, he's always trying to call out the best in us. He's trying to find the gifts in us, and he's calling us. So that is what a pastor does. But it's a whole lot different. What's your name, sir?
Dale.
Dale? Okay. And you together? Can your name?
Lacey.
Dale and Lacey. It's totally different for Dale and Lacey to go out for dinner with another couple who are not in this room and just share the story, not ask them for money, but share their story of how God has blessed Dale and Lacey.
So good.
Yeah. Because I have found this generosity, leaders are always trying to get other people to step up into the generosity circle. Take the generosity challenge. Go on the journey with them. And maybe one of the assignments I'd love to give you is, this is 2017. Then 2018, you'll have to get a much bigger room. Because that's what generous people do. You're always challenging others to step up and step in. Number three, generosity leaders empower the vision of the kingdom. The vision of the kingdom. And the vision of the kingdom for Springs is very multifaceted. You are, how many churches have their own TV and media and handsome pastor? Yeah. I haven't been paid yet, so I'm working. We have one. Mike, stay out of this one. Yeah. just one more zero to the check will change my life. Don't ever let anyone tell you there's no value to zeros. One more zero before the decimal can change your life. Yeah. Empower the vision. It's like saying, I'm all in.
Very good.
I'm all in. So, if that's the vision, yeah, I'm going to get behind that. Because that's what generosity leaders do. They get it. The biggest money I've ever raised, first of all, has been one-on-one at breakfast. Most of my best money came in before 7:30 in the morning. That's just how it was. There's this business club downtown Atlanta called the Commerce Club. That's where is the congregating place. So breakfast from 7 to 7:30, probably that's my biggest monies would come between 7 and 7:30 in the morning, because after that they're off to the races, doing whatever, playing golf or whatever is going on in their life. That's cool. But the biggest monies that I ever raised, they were not interested in a PowerPoint. Not like a gazillion. People who ask a gazillion questions usually give the least. They get it. Just like that, they get it. Now, questioning? Good. Transparency? Good. More information? Good. Trying to improve the plan? Good. But it's they get it. That's who you are. Because generosity leaders empower the vision of the house. And they're in because they get it. They get it. Let me just give you three more. Generosity leaders understand the difference between inheritance and legacy. I've spoken all over the world in different settings. There's a company, one of the largest accounting firms in the world is known as Deloitte. Some of you might know about Deloitte. So Deloitte South Africa somehow got a hold of some of my books, and then they invite me to come and speak. And so I did 2 years in a row, I did President's Breakfast with the Deloitte clients in Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town. In the third year, there's a wealth management company in South Africa for the African continent known as Citadel. Citadel does wealth management for wealthy families. They don't do wealth management for corporations. They do wealth management for families. So Citadel and Deloitte co-partnered to do a breakfast event for what they said the 35 richest people in South Africa. And they flew me from Atlanta to Johannesburg to do a 25-minute not free speech. So they drive me to the Deloitte offices. That is where it was being held, in a beautiful, beautiful room. And they had invited 35 of the richest people in South Africa. I'm in a room right off there. They had a little place where they were congregating. And they come, you know, to see and be seen. It is, you know, that kind of a ritzy place. So I'm in this office, and it's got this mirror. I'm in this window. It's a one-way window. We can see from the inside at them, but they can't see us. So I'm sitting in the office with the CEO of Deloitte and the CEO of Citadel, the wealth management company. And these are the top clients for Deloitte and the top clients for Citadel. So I'm sitting, and they are pointing out who's what, who's who, who's who, who's who. And this one's worth so much, this one's worth so much. And then they asked me, so what are you going to talk about today? And I said, I'm still working on it. That was not the right thing to say. That was not the right thing to say, because they said, you don't know? I said, well, I kind of sort of know. And so they looked at each other, and they didn't say anything after that, so they left me alone. They pointed at a man by the name of Chris, very distinguished, and they said he is the richest man in South Africa. He owns portions of the railroad, portions of commercial airlines, South African Airways, and Seaways. He's in logistics, but they also said that today is his first day of retirement. But he's the richest man in South Africa. Said, okay, cool. So they said, well, let's go mingle. Said, okay, let's go mingle. So we step out there, and these, you know, high talk tables, and everyone's doing their thing. And I'm just kind of moving around. I get to Chris. And I said, hi, Chris, I'm Sam. He says, so you the speaker? I said, yes, sir. He said, I don't want to be here. I said, okay. The only reason I'm here is because she made me. I said, wow, that's a good way to start. So she made you. All right. I said, that's cool. That's cool. That's cool. And then he said to me, so what do you do? I said, I guess for today I'm a speaker. So, but they had told me who he was. He didn't know that. I just moved on from there. And I mingled around all those people. While we were in the back room there, the CEO of Citadel and Deloitte said this to me. They said, Dr. Chen, we know that what you're going to say is going to be fine, but they didn't come here for that. They came here to be with each other and to see who's still married and who's not and who got a facelift. And, you know, this they're not here for you. They're here for themselves. Number two, they said three things to me. I'll never forget it. Number two, they said, most of them, when we have these, usually don't stay for the whole thing, because what's going on out there is what they came for. They will come in and sit for maybe 10, 12 minutes. In the middle of your speech, they'll get up and leave. So don't take it personally. That's what they do. Third thing. So Citadel had and Deloitte had bought my stack of my books. So everyone got a gift of my books with a ribbon on it and everything like that. And they said, now we know that you have offered to sign their books, but these people don't stand in line. So nobody is going to have their books signed. So just want you to know who you're dealing with. I said, that's cool. I mean, the book's already bought. What do I care? You get me a sign. You know? I mean, hey, the important thing is I got the money, and that's just more work, so I don't have to do that. That's cool. I mean, it's not like Springs where you've got to go out there and sign books. So I got to talking to them, and I got on the subject of this point, inheritance versus legacy. And words came out of my mouth that were not planned, that were not planned. If they were planned, they would have never come out of my mouth. And I looked at that room. Now remember, this is a very intimate room. There are just 35 of them, and the CEO, Deloitte, CEO, Citadel, and me. So there are 38 people in the room, just 38 people. And I looked at them and said, you all are filthy rich. You got yachts, you got houses. You got houses not just here, you got it everywhere. None of you flew commercial. Every one of you, if you're out of Johannesburg, flew on your own private jet. You can buy anything, sell anything. You got butlers in your home. There's nothing that money can buy that you cannot buy. So you're in that category. That's why you're in this room. I looked at the CEOs. I said, Deloitte and Citadel, tell me. Deloitte sitting on this side, Citadel on that side. Tell me that you all are the richest people, at least in South Africa. But this is also what I also know, that when you die, these are the words that came out of my mouth. When you die, in some of your cases, not even your children are going to come to your funeral. Chris, remember Chris? Remember Chris? Chris goes, start sobbing. I still can see him sitting right on the left-hand side next to the wall. Starts sobbing. And then somebody else starts crying. My host, the CEO of Deloitte, CEO of Citadel, are looking at me like, you were telling the truth. You didn't know what you were going to say. They have this very concerned look on their face. Half the room is crying. Nobody left. After it was over, I stood at a highboard table like this for 2 hours. They stood in line for 2 hours. Told me their stories. Because, see, anybody can leave an inheritance, but not anybody can leave a legacy. You can buy a whole lot of term life insurance, and you die. Good inheritance. Because inheritance is what you leave behind. Legacy is who you leave behind. Inheritance is stuff. Legacy is people. Two quick stories. And then dessert. Can someone say thank you, Jesus? 1972. I was wanting to come to the United States of America to go to Bible college. And to come to America to go to any kind of Christian or any kind of institution, you need to not just get accepted by the university, you also need a sponsor, an American sponsor with money, not just an American. I didn't know anybody. But there was a couple by the name of Bob and Vivian Steinbaugh who had come through our church in India on a Sunday night, and I had played the accordion for them. In those days, I used to play the accordion. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah. I still got a couple at home. So I played the accordion for them, and that time I was, 19, played the accordion for them on Sunday night service. They're the only Americans I knew. They had an address, 1555 Old Oak Road, Pasadena, California. I wrote them a letter. It said, "Dear Bob and Vivian, my name is Sam. I don't know if you remember me or not, but when you came to my dad's church, I played the accordion for you. I have made an application to a university in Atlanta, and they've accepted me, but they're looking for someone to pay my way, someone to sponsor me. And they'll hold my place for $1,000. So pray about it. If that's what God wants you to do, then that'll be great." And I send the letter off. In those days, it took 3 weeks for the letter to come to the United States, and 3 weeks to get. How many of you remember? That's how it was. So I was not really even expecting them to respond back to me. About a month and a half later, I got a letter from them. "Dear Sam, we remember you. We prayed about it. We want to sponsor you. In fact, we've already sent a $1,000 check. And so I came here." I saw them twice in my life, two times in my life. Once, when I played the accordion for them, just saw them. They sang and I played. That was it. And the second time I saw them for about half hour, when they came to my graduation in 1977, May of 1977. At that time, they had no idea that I'd been in Winnipeg, Canada, talking to a group of people who collectively call themselves Kingdom Builders. They've gone on to be with Jesus, but they left a legacy behind. They had no idea that I'd be traveling all over the world doing whatever I do. But they live on through me. My last story, and then dessert for sure. You know, when a preacher says in conclusion, you know it doesn't mean a thing. It just means I am circling the airport. I see the runway. I'm thinking about it. It's just like giving you hope. It's like hope. It's hope, hope, hope. So in conclusion, it was July 1st of 1989, my first job as president of the university. I drove my car into my spot, and it was my first day. So before I went in the office, I looked over there in the front of the university, a big green area, grassy area, and I saw somebody cutting the grass on just a John Deere lawnmower. So instead of going into the office, I walked across and went over to where he was mowing. And when he came on around, I asked him to stop, and he did. And I introduced myself, said, "Hey, I'm Sam. I'm the new president here." He said, "My name is Benson. I am the janitor here, and I also cut the grass." And I heard there was an accent in his speaking. Unlike me, there was an accent that he had. I said, "Where are you from, Benson?" He said, "I'm from Kenya." It's okay. "You here by yourself?" "No, I'm here with my wife and three children." "Very good. So what program are you in?" So he told me the major he was in and so on and so forth. And he said, "The university has given me a job here to do what I do, and that pays for what I need to be doing in life." But there was something in his eyes that was so inviting. He went on through his school, he finished his bachelor's, I asked him, I said, "What do you want to do, Benson?" And he said, "I don't know." So I just asked him, I said, "Hey, listen, we would like for you to consider being our librarian someday. By then, I had given him odd jobs here, there, the other, got him off the lawnmower, got him, you know, doing different things, because his value to me was more with what he could do with his head than his hands. And so I just brought him inside the office, and part-time here, he had like three part-time jobs at the same time. And he was a foreigner. He was not going nowhere, so I just worked him. Yeah, took advantage of that foreigner. So and so I sent him to Clark Atlanta University to get his MLS, Master of Library Science, and then he had a good business head, so paid for his going for his MBA, and he got his MBA. And by now, I made him like director over international students. We had students from like 63 countries at that time, so he was over them. And then I encouraged him to go on for his doctorate, so he got his Doctor of Education, Ed D, became a vice president. Then in 2000, I made him my executive vice president, so he was like the second in command. So when I was resigning in 2003, my board wanted to know, do you have a recommendation? I said, matter of fact, I do. His name is Benson Karanja. Benson McKenzie Karanja, Dr. Benson McKenzie Karanja. He replaced me. He's still doing a great work there, has grown it to a great degree. But here's the story, end of the story. If you drive on that campus right now, the first building you're going to see on the right-hand side is an auditorium. And they renamed that auditorium to dedicated to me, Samuel R. Chand Auditorium. On the outside, there's a big, literally this big bronze plaque with somebody that looks somewhat like me, with my name and the dates that I was there, July 1989 to December 2003, da-da-da-da-da. The inside is beautiful, gorgeous, flags from all over the world, Samuel R. Chand Auditorium. It's pretty cool to have a building named after you, by the way. Very cool. And you drive past that around the parking lot, around the other place, you go to the administrative offices, you walk through the vestibule, through the lobby, and through a couple offices, and then you walk into the president's office. And there sits Dr. Benson Karanja. That building, as cool as it is eventually going to fall. Eventually, it'll need a lot of repair. Eventually, it's going to go away. That's what buildings do. Doesn't matter how good it is. That's what buildings do. That's not my legacy. When I walk into the president's office and see somebody sitting in the chair I sat for in 15 years, there sits my legacy. On the first day of my job, he was my janitor. July the 1st, 1989, he was my janitor. On December 31st, 2003, he was my president. That is my legacy. My sisters and brothers, that's just not my story. That's your story. Because you are creating legacy. You're not giving. You are creating legacy. You're not leaving an inheritance. You are creating legacy. As kingdom builders, you're not just giving. You are generosity, leaders, leaving a legacy. And that is why the air in this room is so different from other people who are finding problems. You're finding solutions. From other people who are complaining to you saying, how can we be a part of making life better? Instead of cursing the darkness, you are lighting candles. Instead of saying, what are we going to do about this? You're saying, we know exactly what needs to be done about this. And so on behalf of the kingdom, on behalf of the millions of people's lives that you touch on a regular basis and not even realize it. On behalf of the people who've already preceded you to heaven. On behalf of the people who will follow you into heaven. To all the kingdom builders at Springs and all the generosity leaders, on behalf of all of them, I want to say thank you and God bless you. Leave a legacy. Let's have some dessert.